Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and now we do continue our mini-series with Stephen Dubner and Stephen Levitt, the guys behind Freakonomics. Their new book out this week is called Think Like a Freak, and on Monday we discussed the power of saying, I don't know. Yesterday we discussed about why thinking like a child can be so effective and how to do it, and today we tackle a really important question, how you can use the power of freak think to persuade someone who doesn't want to be persuaded. And I can attest to the power of this chapter because I was able to convince Stephen Dubner and Stephen Levitt to come back for a third consecutive day against their will. You should have seen me twist their arm. Stephen, thank you again for joining us.
Hey, Brian, thanks.
Good to be here.
And your first piece of advice in the chapter called How to Persuade People Who Don't Want to Be Persuaded is it might not be worth it to try. And you basically concede that this is an incredibly hard thing to do, so it's about picking your battles.
It's about picking your battles, also realizing the way people make up their minds about important topics. So we'd like to think that we're all open-minded people who assess the available logic and data and information we can and then kind of weigh it and decide what's the right way to think about it. But as a matter of fact, our biases are pretty strong and our preconceptions are strong and we use a lot of shortcuts and we like to think the way that other people in our circles think. And so, yeah, it's true that most people have an ingrained take on a particular topic, and to try to budge them from that can be close to impossible.
Listeners, you want to get in on this? The Freakonomics guys giving their tips about how to persuade someone who doesn't want to be persuaded. But what have you learned from situations like this? 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. And Stephen Levitt, why even frame it like this? Why even do a chapter on persuading people who don't want to be persuaded rather than people who can be persuaded or who are ambivalent about things or undecided? What's your goal here? Is it political? Is it for salespeople? What are you after?
Oh, I'm not sure we have a real objective. I think really what we started from was a position of having been out in the public eye and tried to persuade people on various dimensions and been really, really unsuccessful by and large in doing it. And it just got us to reflect. This book is really a reflection of thinking hard about what's worked and not worked for us. And we came up with a few ideas that seemed to be helpful. And look, who needs help persuading people who can be persuaded? The tough task is how to persuade people who can't be persuaded.
And one of the most interesting things, I think, that you point out is that people often try to persuade through facts, logic, and reason, which is a lovely rational notion, Stephen Dubner, but it's totally not going to work.
I wouldn't say totally not going to work. You know, there are some people, look, if you take 100 people, they have 100 different kind of operating systems going on in their brain and how they judge information and what moves them to think about something or to change their mind. So some people will respond to logic and data and so on. And, you know, engineers and computer scientists will look at a problem differently than someone in the humanities. But it is true that because people have made up their minds about something and that when they've made up their minds about something, and if data and rational thought can't persuade them, one thing that sometimes can is tell a good story. And by tell a good story, we don't mean an anecdote. We don't mean, you know, this happened to my uncle and therefore it is a universal truth. And we also don't mean a story that's meant to be an anomaly. But a story is, you know, a narrative that includes some data and includes some time series to give people a sense of how meaningful this is. And the fact is that stories do change and shape the way that we think about issues in large part because we're all narcissists and we can put ourselves in that story and kind of help to see our way to a different conclusion.
Your tip number one, Steve Levitt, and you do list a number of tips here for how to persuade people who don't want to be persuaded, is that remember that you are just the producer of the argument. But when you try to convince someone, theirs is the only vote that counts. In other words, the fact that you believe your argument doesn't really matter?
Yeah, I didn't learn very many things when I did consulting after I graduated from college. But one thing I sure learned is that usually when people get up in front of an audience, they're talking for themselves and they tell you about, you know, how they got to the answer and why it's important to them. And one thing we got taught in consulting is that nobody cares about the consultant. Only the client means everything. And so really taking the perspective of the person you're trying to persuade, if there's anything more fundamental than that, I don't know what it is.
And don't assume your argument is perfect, Stephen Dubner, another of your tips, which seems like a no-brainer, but I guess it's similar to what we talked about at the beginning. You need to recognize that not every argument is flawless, even your own.
Yeah, don't assume your argument is flawless, but also don't present it like that. I think that's what you see. I mean, look, people who listen to this program, probably many of them read an op-ed page somewhere. It might be the Wall Street Journal, might be the New York Times. The people who like the New York Times probably hate the Journal and vice versa. And what you see in those kind of arenas is a lot of people who are essentially preaching to one kind of choir, but not really trying to persuade. And if you look at the arguments that people make, whether it's on a tax issue or an income inequality issue or a healthcare or food issue, you'll see that very rarely does someone say, you know, here's the problem that I'm trying to address. Here's my solution. And granted, there are all kinds of problems with my solution. There are all kinds of flaws in this. And there are going to be all kinds of costs to the benefits I propose. But I still think that this is the best possible chance. And that's what you don't see in a lot of public policy argument. And that's what we advocate more. Don't pretend your argument is perfect. And also, don't pretend that your rivals have no value or no merit in their argument.
Can you tell me a story, Steve Levitt, of when somebody applied some of these principles to a particular situation?
Yeah, I mean, I'll tell you the one example I have from my own experience is that a long time ago I came up with this controversial theory about the link between legalized abortion in the 1970s and the decline in crime in the 1990s. And that was a controversial idea, and even though I think the data supported quite well, the firestorm of anger and controversy that followed was life-changing. It was reduced my happiness for years. But then when Dubner and I wrote about it in our first book, in Freakonomics, we approached it in a very different way, and we told the story, and we explained it, and we were very level-headed, and we had probably offended a few people on other issues before we got to that chapter, and so people kind of knew more about who we were. And we got no negativity, no outrage there. People really thought about the issue. I think it's really, in my life, it's the most persuasive thing I've ever been able to do with that chapter in Freakonomics.
Yeah, I think one thing that we did in that chapter that I learned a lot from too, and I remember, Levitt, I remember when you suggested this, when we were talking about the story and where it's going to end, and the end basically said, if it's true that the legalization of abortion led to less crime, that shouldn't change the way that you personally, morally, politically feel about the issues. In other words, you have your moral position. And that doesn't mean that because this happened, you should change your position on that. But it does help you understand what cause leads to what effect. And I would argue, Brian, that that's kind of an example of not pretending that every argument you make is the magic bullet that everyone should adopt immediately and the world will be better and full of dancing unicorns and rainbows.
The theory, by the way, Steve Levitt, for people who don't know it, being that unwanted children statistically grow up to commit more crime. So if the abortion rate drastically increased after the 1970s Roe versus Wade decision, then there was a significant number fewer of unwanted children, and that correlated with the decrease in crime. Is that it in a nutshell?
You could not have said it any better than just said it. That was exactly right.
Levitt, I think you actually found who would have been the optimal co-author for this book. That was actually much better than anything we wrote.
Erica and by the way, I will sign on. I will co-author your next book and host the Freakonomics podcast in addition to the show. Erica in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hello.
Go ahead.
I am happy to hear your voice.
And yours. What point would you like to make?
I would like to say that I recently read a book called Voluntary Simplicity. And we are a consumerist society, and our earth is in great trouble. And I grew up in Hungary, and we grew up with many, many proverbs. And one of them was, learn to say no. It will serve you better than if you spoke fluent Latin. And also to listen to your inner voice.
Are you making kind of the opposite point? Learn to say no and stick to it, no matter who's trying to persuade you, even if they're both named Stephen?
Well, I am just saying that it's very hard. I think chronological age has a lot to do with it, to learn to say no. And also, like, if people do not appreciate small things, they don't deserve bigger ones. But I am grateful for your station, and I am going to make a contribution.
Thank you, Erica, and thank you for your contribution to this conversation. Amy in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hi. The tip I would say is don't assume that the person you're trying to persuade thinks in the same way that you do. I've seen like online discussions where somebody says, well, because of this, then, you know, if this, then that. And the other person just doesn't agree with that
premise. Right. That's interesting. And I think it ties to one of the tips that you have in the book, Stephen Dubner, which is acknowledge the strength of your opponent's arguments. And I imagine this is really hard to do because people probably feel like they don't want to argue both sides, or if they give something to the, quote, other side, then it's going to weaken their ultimate chance of persuading somebody.
Yeah, I think that's a great point that Amy's making in that, and this is related to actually another chapter in the book where we write about incentives. It's related. When you try to design an incentive scheme to accomplish some social policy, let's say, and this is similar, let's say, to how to persuade people who don't want to be persuaded, it's very natural to think, well, I'm going to set up the levers of my incentive scheme in a way that would work for someone who thinks like me. But again, you take 100 people in the world and they have 100 different ways of thinking and they'll respond differently to different incentives. So I think that's actually what Amy just said there is really important. And that's why, you know, I don't mean to turn into a shill for this radio station that I love so much. It's why it's really important to not surround yourself with people who think and listen to and read exactly the same stuff as you, because it's really easy to build your own echo chamber and you then operate in this bubble where you're not really open to changing your mind or even really educating yourself well about a topic.
Right. And we're going to end with this comment from Francis from Greenpoint, who writes on our website, I found that people typically won't be persuaded during a conversation, but instead their view changes over time as a result of hearing the points. Stephen Levitt, that's very interesting to me. I mean, there's a point of human resistance, a point of human pride and ego, right? If you're trying to persuade somebody, maybe you shouldn't expect them to stand there and look you in the eye and say, you are right, and I was wrong. I've changed my mind. Rather than let it seep in over time, and then they, they can do it in a sort of less ego-threatening way.
Yeah, I think many times when you try to persuade people, you get into this idea of winners and losers, right? It's an argument. Whoever comes out on top has won it. But if your real goal is to persuade, it doesn't matter who wins or loses. All you want is the person on the other side to come around, and you don't need credit for it. You don't need the burst of adrenaline that comes with having vanquished a foe. So I think that's completely consistent with how we think about changing people's minds.
All right, Stephen Dubner and Stephen Levitt, the Freakonomics guys, have done it again with their brand new book, Think Like a Freak. They're also doing an appearance on stage at Symphony Space tonight, and you can get a discount on tickets by using the promo code WNYC when you go to their website. What time is that at Symphony Space?
I would like to say it is either 7 or 7:30, but unfortunately, I don't know.
And I don't actually have it in front of me, but folks, if you go to their
Before midnight, I know that.
Sometime before he loses his glass slipper, Stephen Dubner and Stephen Levitt will convince you of something. Thanks a lot. This has been a really, really interesting three-part series over the last 3 days. Thanks, guys.
Thanks so much,
Thank
Brian.
You. Thank
Brian
you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and we can now confirm that that is 7:30 tonight at Symphony Space, and you can get a $10 discount on the tickets by using promo code WNYC. A lot more to come. Matt Katz on yesterday's Bridgegate testimony, and he's got clips. Stay with us.